This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. All right, so first of all, we should just clarify, Vermont native John Dewey did not invent the Dewey Decimal System. That was another guy. This Dewey was, however, one of the most important thinkers in all of American history, changing the world with his far-reaching insights into philosophy, education, politics, psychology, art, and more. Born in Burlington in 1859, Dewey is honored in his native city with an annual parade on the Saturday preceding his birthday. There's even a 10-foot papier-mâché puppet of the philosopher that's marched up and down Church Street. That's actually coming up this weekend. And Green Mountain College is hosting a conference devoted to Dewey on October 15th through the 17th. Joining us today to talk about John Dewey and his work are Stephen Fassmeyer, Green Mountain College philosophy professor and the author of the book Dewey. Professor Fassmeyer, nice to have you on the show again.
Good to be on board.
And we're also joined today by Jonathan Miller Lane, who's a Middlebury College professor of education studies. Professor Miller Lane, nice to have you with us.
Good to be here.
All right, so let's clarify then. Who was John Dewey? Stephen Fassmeyer, you wrote the book Dewey. Who was he?
The most popular Dewey right now was not the Dewey Decimal guy. His name is Melville, by the way. I heard he was a seventh cousin of John, but I have no idea. But Dewey the library cat apparently is very popular. So it's not him, not Admiral George Dewey, who was born in Montpelier. Then there was the Dewey defeats Truman guy, right, of the 1948 Chicago troop. Yeah, not him. So this Dewey, as you said, was born in Burlington, Vermont, and indeed was born on Willard Street. There's a historical marker there. And he was born October 20th, 1859. So his birthday will be next week. Archibald and Lucina Dewey were the parents. And five blocks away from there, he was buried. He died in 1952, so I like to say he didn't make it very far, about five blocks. But most of his life, he lived in New York City, and before that, Chicago, University of Chicago, and Columbia University. But he's the most cited academic philosopher of the 20th century. He made arguably the most significant contribution to educational thinking in the 20th century, and he approached philosophy as a necessity, not a luxury, for interpreting a culture, evaluating it, criticizing it, and hopefully redirecting it. And he thought philosophy really mattered when it helps us to deal with the difficulties that we share and when it extends and deepens the sort of experiences that we find to be most worthwhile.
Listeners, I want to know from you, do you know this John Dewey? Do you know his thoughts on pragmatism, his idea of how democracy actually works, what he did in terms of education, thought, and reform, how he might feel about Common Core curriculum? Or are you scratching your head thinking, John Dewey? I'm not sure I know who this guy is. If you have a question or if you want to share your thoughts or your ideas about what he represents in American culture and history, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can ask a question by posting it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Jonathan Miller Lane, do you find that people often don't know a lot about John Dewey?
Yes. In the world of education, and particularly if you've been through the sort of world of teacher education, folks know about John Dewey. So in that world, he's well known and he's well regarded and he's used. But outside of that world, he is little known. It's true.
Well, why do you think that is? I mean, if people who know him say this was perhaps the most American philosopher or most important American philosopher of the 20th century and late 19th century, if not ever, why isn't he somebody who's held up more prominently?
I think his ideas are actually, once you start to work with them, far more radical than people realize. And so if you actually start to work with what he suggested we do, you suddenly encounter very complicated, very interesting, profound commitments to democratic life. And I think there's still a great debate in the country about what schools are for. What really are schools for? Dewey had very specific ideas about that were really fundamentally grounded on the development of individual human beings. You know, that democracy is a way of life and education is a process of living, not preparation for future living. But not everyone agrees. So once you get into it, the debates get quite serious, I think, and there's a lot of disagreement.
Although it would seem that in our current culture anyway, that would be more exciting to people to have somebody who could be a flashpoint.
Yes, it would be if you're willing to play in that, I like to call it the Dewey sandbox. But very often I think people sort of like to imagine that they're interested in the ideas, but to actually work with them and start to imagine every classroom being a place that was this alive with the kinds of interaction Dewey talked about require really demanding teaching. They require careful preparation and really, like democracy itself, a certain tolerance for creative chaos rather than incoherent chaos. And that's an interesting place to be.
Stephen Fassmeyer, do you agree? Do you think that actually John Dewey was a kind of a radical?
Absolutely. Yeah, he's a radical for grown-ups, I'd like to say.
Yeah, nice.
As far as his continuing reputation goes, there's been a resurgence of interest in his work, especially in the last three decades, in philosophy, but also across the academy. And that is exhibited, for example, in its global influence. So over the past 20 years, centers for Dewey studies have opened in China, Italy, Germany, France, Poland, Hungary, Japan, Turkey, Argentina, Spain, Brazil, Ireland, and there's an original center in Carbondale, Illinois. So his influence is really expanding. But he was eclipsed, especially in philosophy departments, for quite some time because there was a view that began with a group called the Logical Positivists that the William James and his predecessor Charles Sanders Peirce and his follower or subsequent philosopher John Dewey were kind of well-intentioned, but they were laboring with really crude tools to develop ideas that were more rigorously shaped by these folks from Central Europe who immigrated here to the United States and to the UK, became known as the analytic tradition in philosophy. And it's a very powerful tradition, but it did tend to exclude the American tradition. And in the last few decades, these traditions have been developing a kind of confluence, and that's been a very powerful thing.
I want to get into some of the areas that John Dewey was influential in, and we can talk about his activism in the women's suffrage movement. We can talk about pragmatism and what that actually means and what it meant to him. But Professor Miller-Lane brought up the question of education and what Dewey's philosophy was on the role of education, what purpose it actually serves in people's lives. So let's dive right into that and grapple with it a little bit. It sounds like he really rejected the idea that a child's brain is a blank slate, and so you are imprinting information onto this person who basically is just open to getting the information from you. So, Professor Miller-Lane, what was his idea of how we learn and what the role of education was?
Yeah, it's really a fun, rich idea in that we have society that has aims for its children. We have an individual teacher. And then we have this human being, this child, that has aspirations to become all that they might become in their lives. So rather than imagine it's the teacher's job to direct and order the classroom, what actually should be at the center of the classroom is the interaction of the child, the curriculum, the teacher, society's aims. And that is a beautiful, rich place in which to interact. And if you can imagine every classroom as being a place where that interaction is taking place, it doesn't mean, as it often has been misinterpreted, that Dewey was all for the teacher leaving the room and let every child do whatever he or she wants, although there's some fascinating free schools that are actually working with that model. But Dewey did not have that idea. His feeling was, so then interpretation and guidance of children's behavior and becomes very, very important. What is the child's interest? Then you match the society's aims and the state's aims and the curriculums with that child's interest. So if you think the purpose of schools is to transmit information and to establish high-performance standardized test scores, then you're going to have a very different kind of classroom than if you're committed to educating citizens in a democracy for democratic life. Can we educate children and adults to actually sustain the discomfort of disagreement that is such an essential part of democratic life? And Dewey thought this was a critical piece. So classrooms should be places where actual deliberations take place. And if you're going to deliberate, that means discussions for the purpose of making a decision about something. That's tough. That's complicated. It requires analysis of content. It requires actually the embodied experience of disagreement, which is richly uncomfortable. So Dewey had, I think, a lovely view that if we can handle this space, democracy is enriched because schools are often the first publics that children are a part of. So take advantage of that and allow this really beautiful, complicated space to be a place of complicated interaction and then nurture it guide it so that the individual is actually becoming fully who they might become in the space rather than just assuming and absorbing a transmission from society.
Stephen Fassmer, you've been writing about Dewey in education and how he might see where we stand now. And we actually got a question from Michael who says, what do your guests think John Dewey would make of Vermont's current education system and the system after Act 46 is implemented? So maybe you can also bring in this idea of Common Core and where he might stand on that.
Yeah, great question. Well, as Jonathan was saying, Dewey's view was that we need to learn that human beings, as kids or adults, learn in an active, personal, imaginative, and direct way. And Vermont has is a mixed bag. I think the national trend, there seems to be a sort of national lockstep march toward a sort of industrial model of education, where we think of knowledge as sort of content delivery and retrieval. And there's a sense that students and teachers are not living creatures in the way that Jonathan was saying, you know, actively exploring, navigating, reaching, grasping, making. That is, there's a sense that for Dewey that we're all active players in who we're becoming and in the world that we're helping to make, and that education can help us to live better. And there's something that's a sort of Jeffersonian value that many Americans still believe in, that that's the point of education. And yet, you know, Scott Walker famously said a few months ago that the mission of education is to develop, here's a quote, to develop human resources to meet the state's workforce needs.
And this is presidential candidate, former presidential candidate.
Yeah, former, right. And that was a clumsy language, and it was destined to fade with his political fortunes, no doubt. But the general outlook, that's not an outlier.
Mm-hmm. No, in fact, we hear that in Vermont. We hear this
we
idea.
We do hear that, yes.
Yeah, education should be preparation for the workforce, and we need to be tailoring the skills we learn in schools to the current workforce demands and future workforce demands.
Exactly. And so it's typical of those who approach education primarily as a way to fuel industry with skilled labor. And that's become an increasingly dominant educational model. From Dewey's standpoint, it's miseducative and it's anti-democratic because you're basically treating people, you know, it's sort of like providing a padded yoke for the workforce so that students can be trained and productively driven down these sort of vocational rows that are pre-existing, right? Students aren't players. They're not helping to create the world that we're all part of, but they're just going to go down the rows that already exist. Mm-hmm. And that's deeply disturbing to Dewey.
But you've written, Stephen Fassmer, that you don't think Dewey would necessarily be opposed to the Common Core curriculum.
No, but it's no reason whatsoever to think that he would be opposed in principle. So what if we think of the Common Core as viewing teachers as informed facilitators, they're skilled, they're experienced, then he would have no objection to that. The proof's in the pudding, of course. What he would challenge is a tendency among Common Core reformers to take a sort of inflexible yardstick to standardize measures of what's thought of as educational progress in a uniform way across school districts, across individuals, across state borders, across the entire country. And that is not about educating the individual to live better. That's not an education for human growth, for intellectual vitality, for receptiveness to the beauty of the world, for ecological responsibility. It doesn't seem to keep in mind the fundamental goals that are really both have roots deep in American civilization, but are also worthy of retaining and of cherishing. We seem to be throwing a lot of that overboard. And so suspicion about the Common Core can't be separated from suspicion about that industrial model that seems to be taking over. So if we could kind of separate the Common Core from that industrial model, we could make something work quite well. There's nothing wrong with standards. We have to have them.
We got a question from Valerie in Burlington who says, to paraphrase Dewey, quote, people are lazy in pursuit of purposes not their own. So Valerie asks, how can we let students find their own purpose authentically within today's curriculum? What do you think, Jonathan?
Yeah, I think it's possible. And I think I really like the way Steve framed that. Having standards is not the problem. The Common Core in and of itself can actually be a space where we can start to talk. If then you use a standardized form of assessment as the ultimate form rather than as a diagnostic tool to let you know how students are doing, this is the problem when the standardized test becomes high stakes and we determine who's failing and who's not based on a single measure. If it's part of a whole toolbox of diagnosis of how we're doing, that's okay. I think in any classroom, a really dynamic teacher has the ability to take what any state in the country wants for its student and to look at that and say, okay, so what's the intent? What's the expectation? So how do I make my space an alive place to do that? Principals who are essential leaders of their school buildings can make their schools places where that aliveness can happen. So I think you can have a school where students can become who they might be within a context of standards. That's not an impossible, it's a dynamic tension, but it's a rich one. I don't think it can limit it necessarily.
See, this is what happens when you start talking about John Dewey, right? You start with his philosophy and ideas, and suddenly you're grappling with something, heading towards an idea of truth, trying to figure out maybe what the ultimate truth is. We're talking about John Dewey today. And listeners, if you are a Dewey groupie, you can tell us why you think he's worth talking about, worth learning from. If you think his ideas hold up today, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Philosopher and education reformer John Dewey was a Vermont native whose ideas changed the world. We're talking about his life, his work, and his far-reaching influence today. And if you want to weigh in with your reflections, or maybe you have a question for our Dewey experts, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or continue the conversation, grapple with these ideas on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking with Green Mountain College philosophy professor Stephen Fessmeyer, who's the author of the book Dewey, and with Middlebury College professor of education Jonathan Miller Lane. And we're hearing from some of you now as well. Let's go to Bill, who's calling in from Stowe. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. My name is Bill, and I'm wondering if your guests are familiar with the Putney School in Putney, Vermont, which I think is one of the outstanding examples of Dewey's years of education put into implementation, founded in 1935 by a woman named Carmelita Hinckman, who I believe actually might have studied under John Dewey in Chicago.
And Bill, what do you think is so special about the Putney School? How does it embody Dewey's ideas?
Well, I attended the Putney School in high school, grades 9 through 12. I grew up on the campus as my father was the teacher and then assistant director there. It's very liberal, free-thinking. The classes are structured, as your guests were just speaking of, co-educational, boarding school, as well as day school, which was quite controversial at the time. I think the inclusion of outdoor work or play, sports, but not for the sake of competition, but just developing the well-rounded personality, debate in the classroom, not using textbooks, using original source materials.
Bill, this is really interesting. Thank you for sharing that and for bringing the idea of the Putney School in. When you mentioned the idea of sports, but not just for competition, you got a finger in the air from Jonathan Miller Lane. And what was that about?
Yeah, actually, my brother-in-law went to the Putney School, so I'm familiar with it. Yeah, I think this was a really important idea that actually Dewey talked a lot about that gets missed by so many of us, that there actually is a way in which the whole body, that literally somatically we have understandings that matter. And if we're talking about the conscious control of our own lives, that cannot mean only a conscious control of intellectual thought, but conscious control of the actual body. So you cannot achieve the conscious control of the individual without an embodied experience. So here's an interesting example to think about in that regard. If you actually come back to that notion of the purpose of education in a democracy is to get us to really deepen our ability to handle deliberation. And we know that disagreement is actually an embodied act. When we disagree, our pulse rate increases, we get flushed. can you actually notice when that's happening? And can you actually develop a somatic ability to handle the literal physical discomfort of disagreement? So even though we say we should disagree with ideas and not people, well, that's lovely, but it's my idea you're disagreeing with. I'm feeling that physically. So it's a really interesting place to explore that actually Dewey talked a lot in his work with F.M. Alexander is very interesting in this regard, and how he came to understand that actually the experience of conscious control is an embodied one, just as the experience of democratic life is actually embodied wholly. And if we thought about that and thought about what kind of ways could we attend to that in schools, I think it could make a really interesting contribution to civic education.
I want to make a turn in a moment here to pragmatism and what that meant and why John Dewey espoused that idea. But let me bring in a couple more comments from our listeners first about education. Maggie's calling in from Putney. Hi, Maggie. You're on the air.
Hello. I live in Southern Vermont. And another educator who was very much influenced by Dewey is Donald Watt, who founded the Experiment in International Living. And he believed that people learn about other cultures by living in other cultures. And since then, thousands and thousands of young people in the United States have gone abroad, both with his programs at the Experiment in International Living, but also with other programs that were founded on the same principles. And then as a language teacher trained at the School for International Training, Dewey's ideas influenced all of us as well, because learning a language is a skill that embodies your body and your mind and your emotions. And so Dewey is very much alive in at least the international branch of education.
Maggie, thanks for sharing that. How neat to hear how you think about Dewey in the work that you've been doing. And Mark is on the line with us from Fletcher. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. Your thoughts, too.
Thank you. I was a former teacher at Burlington Tech and an elementary school before that, and I was studying education in the late early 70s, and I was very, very taken with Dewey's take on how it integrated into the general democratic pluralistic society. I see that only happening now at elitist levels, and as resources have dwindled and we're fighting over peanuts to sustain a democratic, educated population, we're veering more and more towards the testing and control top-down issues. I'm wondering, from my sense, I thought the vocational, technical, not vocational anymore, technical, I guess, was the richest setting for that kind of development, as long as there were, you know, all the other aspects of intellectual life present. So I wanted to know why we haven't invested more in that. The bang for the buck, socially, personally, is so much greater. Thank you.
Mark, thanks for the call. Stephen Fessmeyer, what do you think?
What a great set of questions.
That's a great question.
Let me put a few of these together. Comment about living in other cultures, I did want to mention that Dewey lived for over 2 years in China, and he developed a comparative East-West standpoint that informed his philosophy, his mature philosophy. He was there 1919 to 21. This question about the technical setting I think is a crucial issue and about elitism. Dewey was powerfully anti-elitist, and one of the things he criticized about what I guess could be called traditional liberal education is the way in which it separated the head from the hands. Vocational, technical education were, you know, what the masses would be educated for to develop very particular skills. That is, they're going to be serfs to the workforce. And then the rich, the haves, end up getting this rich cultural education. And Dewey said everyone deserves a liberal education, a liberal cultural education. He also thought that occupational interests that people bring into an educational setting are crucial. And what we've got to stop doing is separating out the idea that we're going to have a cultural education from a practical education. So if we want to mix the cultural and the practical. And so this is the authentic education model. We're not, as Jonathan said, it's not a child knows best attitude. He rejected the idea that being child-centered means that we're just going to be governed by whatever the child wants to do here and now. But nonetheless, what we want, whether it's a technical education or whatever, if we want to prepare people for the so-called real world, that it's not about treating students as pawns being prepared for the workaday world of adult life, or teachers being treated as functionaries for that. It serves the public good when our professions, our technical professions, our occupations, our on-the-ground pursuits are energized by educational institutions that are cultures of imagination and they're cultures of growth. And we want teachers and students involved in creating that sort of culture and that sort of rich imaginative engagement. Otherwise, a child's education, whether it become a technical education or otherwise, is just a story of lost possibilities.
So, Steve, broaden that out then to, I mean, we've been talking about how John Dewey envisioned education and how it could serve the ideals of society. And this was sort of a practical application then to his overarching philosophy, which was what?
Well, ask me on a different day, I'll give you a different, yeah. different answer. You know, a cornerstone of his philosophy in a nutshell, I like, it's like Twitter or maybe haiku to state something really concisely. And what I said in the book is a cornerstone of his view was that you should always state your objectives in terms of the means that right. you plan to use to attain them. Right. So when you listen to VPR, Morning Edition, or All Things Considered, or whatever, sometimes we just can't help but say, my goodness, that's political idea. That's a stupid idea. And we do this every day, all of us. And so, for example, let's build a fence across the border with Canada. Was it Walker who said that a few months ago? Right. So the goal mm-hmm. is to improve border security. And so he proposes building a fence. Well, that has a few other consequences that his pet theory, you know, is not going to take into consideration. Or the idea that we should arm teachers, right? We're going to improve school security by arming teachers. So often when we say, my goodness, that doesn't sound like a good idea, what we're failing to do is to state what our goal is in terms of the means we plan to use to attain them. There is a quickie fun
story.
Well,
wait, let me interrupt you there because, you know, some people I can imagine are saying now to the radio, wait, I don't think that's a bad idea. So, you know, according to Dewey's idea of how we have to argue through to get to a truth, how would you apply that to that issue, say? Because the question of arming teachers, for example, is one that actually is a fairly active debate at the moment. And people are pretty passionate on both sides of it.
Of course. So Dewey's not going to weigh in on he might think this or that ultimately is not a good idea, or he might say that's a stupid idea. But his point is about the method that we're going to use. What does it mean to think through something critically? And so what he wants to build is a democratic setting for people to weigh in and to have differences of opinion on that. But the thing is that we often achieve some isolated objective, say lowering taxes, making schools more efficient, making higher ed more affordable, stabilizing health care, balancing budgets, getting universal health coverage, securing the right to bear arms, weaning ourselves from Middle East oil, democratizing the Middle East by invading Iraq or whatever. We often achieve some isolated objective that we prefer and we really get fixated on, but it's irresponsible to think that we've done just that one thing that we're fixated on, while ignoring all the other consequences that are brought about by achieving that objective. And that has been a catastrophic recipe for moral, political, educational, ecological nearsightedness. We can do better. And what Dewey was good at and is an undertapped resource for is to try to set educational conditions for us to get better at just that sort of critical thinking instead of saying, well, people are just, you know, to, yeah, they just can't do it. They're just inherently incompetent. They have to be led by the expert heads, you know, that democracy just can't work, especially participatory democracy. That's been a view by the expert-driven people for centuries. And Dewey was an advocate for the view that we could have this democratic discussion and disagree with each other. Again, we're going to disagree in the end, often, about what we ought to do. But the stage for that discussion is one where we can actually get better at being democratic citizens.
And I think there's a lovely way to extend this into another situation. What I think about being as a college prof, what are the consequences of self-destruction that is necessary to live a life in high school, to get into a place like Middlebury? Once you're at a place like Middlebury, in the service of an academic goal or achieving some standard of living, what exactly are you willing to sacrifice in your own bodily health and well-being? And isn't that exactly similar to the sacrifices we are willing to make of the environment for our own material gain? So I think if we ignore the consequences of these ends of what we perceive now under our current cultural context as achievement, as success, we're doing this unconscious reproduction of habit. And if we're going to inhibit that a little bit and slow it down, we have to become more conscious. And to come back to this body piece, we've got to look at the consequences of those ends. And I think I see it in my students. I see it in ourselves. What are we doing to ourselves as we achieve the standard of living? And is that, in fact, an analogy for what we're doing to the environment as we try and achieve a certain level of material success?
Boy, it's interesting to get into this stuff. And listeners, if your interest has been piqued, you can go to Burlington this Saturday and see the giant, I think it's a 10-foot papier-mâché puppet of John Dewey that is paraded up and down Church Street in honor of his upcoming birthday. There's also the first pragmatism conference, the first meeting of the pragmatists.
The New England Pragmatist
Forum. Way to go, Steve.
That's right. And that is coming up Thursday through Saturday at Green Mountain College. Jonathan Miller Lane, Middlebury College professor, Stephen Fessmeyer, philosophy professor at Green Mountain College and author of the book Dewey. Thank you both so much for illuminating this discussion.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Jane.
Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In one photo, apples, crispy bacon, shredded cheddar cheese, and a couple of sprigs of fresh sage rest on a weathered wooden cutting board, ready to be made into savory scones. In another photo, a pink flower with an inner yellow base. The flower's the size of a silver dollar. It practically glows in the palm of a soil-streaked hand. This is the work of Thomas McCurdy and Bailey Hale. Together, they own Ardelia Farm in Irisburg. Their Instagram account is full of beautiful flowers and baked goods, pigs and tiny chicks. And they've leveraged their ability to tell a story about their farm into a successful crowdfunded campaign to build a greenhouse that will help them expand their growing flower operation. I stopped by for a visit, and Thomas explained how he and Bailey wound up in the Northeast Kingdom.
Originally, we're living in Philadelphia. Bailey was a floral and event designer and sang with the Philadelphia Opera, and I was working as a pastry chef. And we decided about 4 years ago that we were ready to get out of the city and just get back to the earth. We really loved food and wanted to be more involved in where our food came from. And so we found some rented land up in central New York State, and we had two different rental farms over the past couple of years just to make sure we liked the farm life and were cut out for it. And the time came to buy, and we looked far and wide throughout New England and beyond, and all signs pointed to the Northeast Kingdom.
You know, it's a cliche, right, to be city folk who move to Vermont and start a farm, but it sounds like you guys are breaking the cliched stereotype in a couple of ways. Primarily, you're trying to grow flowers in the Northeast Kingdom. I mean, maybe that fits the stereotype in that, you know, there, it's going to be a remarkable failure and you'll have to go back to the city with your tails between your legs. But that's not the aim here, right? What are you trying to do?
So as we were looking at eating more local food and knowing where our food comes from, I was also using all these flowers from South and Central America, and it didn't really make sense to me. So it's something I wanted to do, but we needed our own land because we're raising a lot of perennial things, woody plants that take a few years to mature. Yeah, the climate in the Northeast Kingdom is a challenge. But there are some things we can do better here than anywhere else. Our peonies don't flower until July here, and the entire rest of the East Coast is finished by that point. The only option is to get them out of Alaska at that time, but I can have them to Boston or New York or Philadelphia in an afternoon without using air freight. be planting 1,500 this fall and probably every fall until we have a couple acres full.
So I started to become aware of your farm when you had started an Indiegogo campaign to get, I believe it's this greenhouse built, right?
It's about 2,500 square feet. And it just gives us an extra month to 6 weeks in the spring and the same in the fall. We can have frost any month of the year up here. So this really lets us grow some things that otherwise would not be possible here in Vermont, at least this far north in Vermont.
What are you growing? First of all, I'll say it's beautiful in here, and you can feel the humidity. My glasses fogged up a little bit when we walked in, and quite a bit warmer. And you've got, were they guinea fowl or chickens that were
running
around?
Oh, yeah, there are a few baby guinea fowl in here. This year was about growing lots of different things to see what we can do well here. I devoted a quarter of the greenhouse to dahlias this year, which have been kind of a flop because of insect problems, but we can do better next year. But I have calla lilies, I have lysianthus, celosia, dianthus, lots of regular lilies. You name it, we've got a little bit of it growing this year. We'll narrow that down a lot next year. Sweet peas will be one of our main focuses in 2016. Most places they die in June because it gets too hot. But ours have lived and thrived all summer long because we just never have heat here.
And is it mostly a local market that you're selling to, or using your flowers for, you know, for weddings, for floral arrangements, or are you selling to, as you mentioned, you can get them to Boston pretty quick?
This year it's been mostly selling at farmers markets. One big wedding using mostly our own flowers. And then I have a handful of florists who have been calling me and either coming here to cut themselves or, you know, I'll have bunches ready for them. So we put a lot of miles on the truck this year.
And Thomas, I think people at some of the farmers markets, Burlington for one, are feeling like they're gaining the freshman 15 from the, you are the baker, right, in the family?
That's correct, yep. I was baking professionally in Philadelphia before we started farming and left that behind to farm full time. We were raising goats and poultry and sheep, and I was happy with the direction that our lives were headed, but I always felt that a little something was missing because I just love baking so much. And then after moving up here, we realized that there's so many wonderful ingredients produced locally, either here on our farm or from our neighbors, that that we can bake with. So with our own eggs and almost entirely our own produce, as well as local flour and buttermilk, butter, we're able to produce an array of baked goods that we have been selling for the past couple of years now at local farmers markets. And we've been really well received. It's been a lot of fun. And I feel so fortunate to be able to turn my passion into a way for us to make a living while working off of our land and supporting our neighbors.
Luckily, the bakery has sustained us this season and allowed us to try out some new things with the flower farm, but I see that growing a lot next year. In the year 2020, we'll really start harvesting our peonies, but especially once those have come to maturity, I think we'll have a viable business here.
There's a lot of talk about how the only viable farm businesses that are at least done on the small scale in Vermont need to be diversified farms, and you guys have that covered. But there are also a lot of farms and farmers that start out and fail. What's different about how you're doing it?
I think for starters, we make such a great team, and we both have a lot to offer, but we have very different skill sets that complement one another. So while I head off to the bakery in the morning, Bailey's here in the greenhouse and out in the fields, and then we can join forces at the end of the day to do evening chores and then start working on the plan for the next day. Also, it's important to not discount the power of social media. We feel really fortunate to have such a strong social media presence, and we really prioritize just staying active and involved and communicating with folks, not only locally, but beyond, and really representing ourselves authentically. We don't try to paint a beautiful bucolic picture that isn't our reality. It's important for us just to be ourselves. But our social media presence and all the folks who follow us and have reached out has really allowed for us to grow as quickly as we have. Without all of those people on Facebook, Instagram, we wouldn't have been able to raise the funds to put up this greenhouse.
That was a $10,000 campaign, and you raised a little bit more than that, right?
I think our goal was about $10,000. We ended up with close to $13,000.
Thomas, I appreciate what you said about not trying to paint a bucolic or beautiful picture that's not there, but I have to say the photos are bucolic and beautiful. I mean, you clearly have a sense of how to present things, you know, how to present the animals and how to present your baked goods and how to have that rustic but sophisticated feel in what you're doing. So, you know, it may be totally authentic, but I think you can't discount that it's also bucolic and beautiful.
We don't take anything for granted here. We every day appreciate the beauty around us, and whether it's the animals or the flowers or the view of the mountains, the color in the trees, or the beauty of even a cookie. We try to, in every opportunity we have, just take a moment and really appreciate it. And if we happen to have our phones on us to snap a picture, then we love the opportunity to share that.
You both have mentioned the power of supporting your local community and feeling supported. What are a couple examples of how you feel like you're fitting into the community here?
You know, we had no idea what to expect coming up here. We had done very little research. We knew no one. We hadn't even ventured into many of the towns and villages in the area. We just we felt pulled to the area. We came and looked at this farm with our realtor when there was a blizzard and maybe 4 feet of snow on the ground, and we put on our boots and trudged out to the pasture. And at the top of the hill there, we both just looked at each other and knew this is where we belong. This is home. And within really short order, just a matter of weeks, we developed a great network of like-minded people with similar priorities and passions, and fortunate to have wonderful neighbors. And unlike anywhere we've lived before up here in the Northeast Kingdom, I think because we're so isolated, we're all working together because we're all in this together. So whether our neighbor is racing to put up hay or we are racing to put up our greenhouse, you name it, our neighbors are canning tomatoes all afternoon. Everyone gets together and helps out because we're all in this together.
Really?
Yeah, really. It's it's true. Sometimes we have to pinch ourselves. It really doesn't feel real sometimes, like we live in this storybook village. And it's certainly not all that way, of course. But yeah, we feel so fortunate to have found the community we have in such a short period of time.
What else are you excited about that you'd like to show me? I also feel bad. I feel like we're letting the warm air out of the greenhouse. Is that a problem?
No, it's okay this time of day. We can go look down here. We can walk out to the field, flower field, and back.
Am I okay on this?
Yeah, you're fine. We're at the very end of the season, so most things are pretty tired and worn out. They say a good flower farm, you never see the flowers because they've all been picked and bunched and sold. We're coming up on the remnants of our field-grown flowers. You can see we've had a few frosts and one good killing freeze here. So the marigolds are kind of brown with orange flowers on top.
Well, it's very fall-like.
So we have close to a half an acre here that will be in full production next season. And then on the next hillside is a one-acre plot that we've been preparing for our peonies. We'll start planting 1,500 roots, hopefully before the ground freezes solid.
So tell me a little bit more about the idea behind American flower growers, thinking that you can sort of claw back some of that market from Ecuador and other places in South America where we typically get a lot of our commercial flowers from.
Traditionally, florists grew their own flowers. That's how it's been in the United States since the beginning. I don't have the exact statistics, but upwards of 80% of our flowers are now imported from Central and South America. And I think maybe of that 20% we do grow in the U.S., 80% of that comes from California. So really a very small amount is being produced on the local level. It's about 10 years behind sort of the slow food movement, but people are really starting to pay attention to where their flowers come from.
Why should they care? I mean, if I can get, you know, $1.50 roses at the corner store for Valentine's Day, why should I care about spending more, possibly or probably getting different flowers and making sure that they're American grown or locally grown?
You know, helping to support a local farmer, if you value farmland and seeing farms stay productive, that's one way you can do it. The chemicals and pesticides that are used in Central and South America, they don't have to declare what's on them. So you really don't know what you're bringing into your home, what you're touching, what is around your kids. And also, you know that, you know, you're generally paying a living wage to someone.
What do you think the difference is in price for cut flowers for somebody who wants to support that?
Some items, the really best grown locally, peonies, don't travel that well. They're not imported well. So you get the best quality if you're buying it from the source. And you generally get a better price than if you're going to a florist who's, by the time it leaves South America, the importer takes their cut, the wholesaler takes their cut, then the florist takes their cut. Not a whole lot of profit goes back to the farmer, and you're paying a pretty good price. So if you can pay that price directly to the farmer, I think you usually get a better value for your dollar.
But as American consumers, are we going to have to rethink things like roses, or are brides going to have to be not less picky, because I would never ask a bride to be less picky, but choose differently in terms of what kind of floral arrangements we expect to be able to get at a moment's notice?
Yeah, I think this new farmer florist movement does ask of the client that they be a little bit flexible. You know, we can get any color at any time. We can work with certain feels, certain textures. But there are some things, like roses, that are difficult to grow without a greenhouse. They're very intensive with fertilizers, with pesticides. They're prone to lots of disease. So there is some give and take there.
Well, Thomas and Bailey, thank you so much for showing me around your farm and welcoming me to your home. I appreciate it, and good luck.
Thanks so much for coming out.
Thomas McCurdy and Bailey Hale own Ardelia Farm in Irisburg. All right, Bernie, Hillary, and the other three candidates will stake out their positions in Las Vegas tonight in the first Democratic presidential debate. Tomorrow on this program, we'll recap what was said and who helped their campaign the most. You can let us know what you heard during the debate. Tune in to the program tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.